My name is Ed Goldberg. Welcome to Author Author, an occasional series of conversations with authors touring through Portland or whom I have reached by phone. My name is Ed Goldberg, and I'm pleased to be speaking with Val Berlinski. Val, welcome to All Classical.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
The title of your book is The Girl Who Slept with God, and it's published by Viking. I understand there's at least one previous instance of a girl who slept with God.
One that we know of.
One that we know of, yes. Yeah. I'll tell you a joke later. But that's, there's a family called the Quanbecks. They live in Idaho. It's what, 1970?
70.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
A very fraught year. Actually.
Definitely.
Definitely, yeah. And there's Orin, who's the daddy.
Right.
And there's Esther, who's the mom. There's Grace, the oldest daughter. Jory, who's the middle kid, and Frances, the little girl, and who remains the only innocent in the whole...
True.
Yeah, alas. But she's how old now?
She's probably 7 or 8,
yeah,
I think.
Okay. When the book opens, Orin has exiled Grace and Jory to this... They live in Idaho, so it's not like downtown Manhattan to begin with.
But nothing like
not
that.
Yet. And this, the Arco is the name of the town that
yes.
they live in. And
yeah.
he takes them out to this house on the fringe of Arco. One
the
can only
very
imagine.
Edge, yes.
And drops them off with little more than a little bit of food and a bunch of boxes.
Yep.
And the place is a mess and a wreck. And he says, "You're staying here until I tell you."
Exactly.
And then walks away. And as a story, as you pick up the story from before that happens, they eventually, we wind up finding out how Grace and Jory are there. But well, I want to talk about Grace. Grace is, again, an interesting name.
Yeah.
Yeah. Given that the other kids are named Jory and Frances, Grace is an interesting name. And she is a holy girl.
She certainly is. She
yeah.
lives up to her name.
And their church is the, let's see if I can get this right, the Garden of Gethsemane Church of the Nazarene.
Yes.
With Pastor Ron presiding, yes?
Yes.
Yeah. And they're a holiness church.
Definitely. Evangelical.
Evangelical Bible church.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, yeah. And everything's pretty much fine because people are, you know, they're nice people. They show Christian virtue to one another.
Mostly.
Yeah. And what happens is that Grace decides that she wants to do a mission in Mexico. You mm-hmm. want to tell us about that?
Well, she's 15 or 16 when she first gets the idea that she really wants to go on missions to either Central or South America, somewhere where people speak Spanish, and she can, quote, witness to the heathen. So when she is 17, she goes on her first mission to Mexico. Her parents are not thrilled about this, even though they themselves are devout fundamentalists. They're a little worried about their oldest daughter because she has taken their religious ideals and virtues several steps further. And so she does. She goes off on this mission, and then they find out that she's coming back early. They're a little concerned. They think she might have contracted some sort of, you know, digestive problem, some illness. And when she gets back, they take her to the doctor and find out that she's pregnant. And when they talk to her about this, she says, yes, very proudly, this is God's child. She's been impregnated by God. And her parents, needless to say, have a very difficult time with this, even though they themselves believe in the notion of the virgin birth. Here's their own daughter telling them that she indeed was another virgin who's supposedly going to give birth to God's child.
Yeah, and therein follows a group of very, very poor decisions on the part mm-hmm. of the parents. Now, Grace, to give her her due, is a stubborn,
very,
willful person.
Absolutely. Totally strong-willed, will not listen to what anyone else has to say. She makes up her own mind.
In fact, her father tells a story late in the book when he's talking to Jory. His father tells a story about when she was a little girl. Why don't you tell us that story?
Yes. And I'm afraid I stole that story directly from my older sister's childhood, in which it was evident to my parents that, or I should say the fictional parents in the book, they're almost interchangeable, that their oldest child was very strong-willed, very willful. She did not want to take off her clothes at night to put on pajamas. And my father evidently one night forced his daughter to change into her pajamas. And she was so furious that she, besides sort of beating up on him physically, she finally said to him, "If you knew how much I hated you, you'd hate me too," which I thought was an amazingly astute comment for a little child to say. So from the get-go, my sister and also the older sister in this book, she cannot be made to do something she does not want to do, ever.
Now, we see this story pretty much from Jory's point of
yes.
view. She's the central character in the book, and kind of everything kind of revolves around her.
Right. She's the narrator. Her point of view, you know, we only know what she allows us to know. Yeah.
When she gets stuck in the house with Grace, although she loves her sister,
yeah.
and she wasn't quite sure what was going on, she's coming back from Mexico because she's sick, you know,
mm-hmm.
right? She begins to resent the idea
Definitely.
That she's stuffed into this place in the middle of nowhere. Now, she goes to Arco Christian Academy.
Yes.
And she wonders where the heck she's going to go to school. What are
yeah.
the arrangements that Oren makes
oh.
for them?
Well, he's found some tiny little public school way out between these two small cities that Jory has never seen before. And it turns out to be a public school where rather rough kids go.
The goat ropers. What's
goat
a goat
ropers?
Roper?
You don't know what a goat roper is?
Well, I mean, I can just people who rope goats, but that doesn't begin to explain it, right?
They're farm kids who are tough, and they ride horses and shoot guns and have rifles in the back of their pickup trucks. They work the rodeo circuit. You know, they're older than their age group would indicate. They're really tough. And when they go to school, they get off certain days during hunting season. I mean, they're just not your typical high school kids. And Jory has been isolated from just exactly that type of person her entire life until now, when she's instantly and unceremoniously thrust into the midst of, you know, tough kids who
schism
you know,
high.
Schism.
What is this a private joke or?
I wish that it were. It is a private joke, but it was also the name of a high school way
Seriously.
Out there. Yeah.
yeah,
schism.
Did you grow up in Idaho? Or?
I did. Uh-huh. Oh yes.
And where do you live now? Just out of curiosity.
I've spent most of my time since Idaho living in San Francisco.
Okay, that's different.
Big change.
Big change. Yeah. Well, it's close to the ocean for one thing.
Oh yeah.
yeah. Jory's 13.
Yes.
She's on the verge of changes herself,
mm-hmm.
Which kind of figure into the story after
yeah,
a while.
Yeah, they definitely do.
And she is beginning to become restless with the religious eccentricities
yes.
of her family.
She's, yeah.
She knows there's something different out there, and she's not really getting—I mean, she has a friends at Arco Christian, but they're all pretty much like her, and
right.
their families are all pretty much like her family.
Yes. Yeah.
And when she goes to schism— the world opens up to her, even in a place like that.
Exactly. For all of a sudden, she can see people dressing very differently, speaking in a rather idiomatic, a slang, swearing-filled hallways of high school. These kids chew, they smoke, they drink, they dance, which for her is, you know, an illicit activity.
No dancing, and no pierced ears ever.
No, no movie going. You don't go to bowling alleys. You don't go to, you don't play pool. You don't go to restaurants where they serve alcohol. I mean, you're just.
Ooh, no. Card games. Only Uno?
Only Uno.
Yes.
Yes. No betting, no gambling. No, no.
This is the list of
proscriptions.
Yes, the list of proscriptions is very funny.
It is. And only. When you're not living that life. Later, it seems very funny.
Yeah,
but when you're a kid, you yeah. think, oh.
You well, know. I don't know. If you've never had television, you don't miss it, really. Do
I
you?
Don't. Well, all your friends, your friends outside of the church, you can see they're going to movies. They're going off and doing things like playing miniature golf. They're going to the bowling alley. And you're like, why can't we do these things? What's wrong with these things?
How are you going to keep them down on the farm after
yeah.
they've seen the bowling alley?
Exactly.
There's an incident at a local store
mm-hmm.
that happens with Jory, and
yeah.
it's a shame when it happens, and it turns out to be much worse. So tell us just briefly what goes on there.
Sure. And this I stole from my own life, too. So I and Jory, we, not together, but separately, went to a drugstore to buy our first bra. We'd saved up money from our babysitting money. And Jory goes to the store. She's very excited. And then she's illicitly holding earrings up to her ears and imagining what it would be like to get to wear earrings. And while she's doing this, a male employee grabs her arm very tightly, drags her back to the employee room, and says, hand them over. And he claims that she has stolen a pair of earrings. And Jory, of course, is saying, I didn't. He makes her take off all her clothes to supposedly search her for these earrings, which he, of course, does not find. And when she, for almost the worst part of this experience is that when she goes home and very shakily, tearily tells her parents what has happened, her father says, well, you better not go back to that store again. And her mother says, why were you trying on earrings? You know pierced ears are a sin. So I think that might be Jory's first indication that to her parents, public shame is the most important thing, meaning it precludes her own safety. They're not upset that she is, you know, they may be upset that she was stripped by a strange man in a drugstore. But what they're really worried about is whether or not anyone else is going to find out that she supposedly shoplifted.
You know, I wasn't really going to bring this up, but that's really what the story is all about, isn't it?
Yes.
Oren and Esther and the way they treat Grace and the whole stinking mess is made worse by the fact that they just don't want people to know what the
exactly.
heck's going on with them.
Right. If that hadn't played such an enormous role, things might have been better. But because they were made to be hidden, you know, secreted away, that just exacerbated absolutely everything that takes place after that. Because Oren can't then keep track of his daughters anymore in the way that he had previously. And things start to escalate in a way that he had not imagined at all, obviously.
Not to sell Oren short. Oren is an ogre in this thing, but he's also a complicated ogre.
Very.
Yes. He's a scientist.
Yes.
And he has been able to reconcile his scientific beliefs with his religious beliefs, mm-hmm. and in fact gives astronomy lectures at the church to people.
Right.
And tell us about that a little
well,
bit.
Well, he tries to say that, you know, he gives scientific explanations for the way in which the entire universe was created required such, according to him, minute calibrations that it could have only happened if there had been a superior being in charge. You know, the least little calculation, and there wouldn't have been enough sun, there wouldn't have been enough water, et cetera, et cetera. And to him, that makes enough sense. He truly believes that there is a God at work creating scientific principles. And to him, that's a very satisfactory answer also because he loves safety and comfort and being reassured. He's the type of guy who does not like unanswered questions, even scientific ones. So he goes out of his way to try and reconcile these two perhaps irreconcilable notions.
He's come up with intelligent design before the phrase existed.
Yeah, he did. And that was his sort of motto, that yes, indeed, there was evolution, but that God was in charge of every bit of the change involved.
Can I ask you to take a level of abstraction on this,
sure.
on this book and story? And at what point does the desire to raise a pious family become abusive?
I think when the parents put their own religious values above the long-term well-being of their children, when they're more interested in maintaining their own sort of pride in being seen as sinless and wonderful standards of Christianity.
Isn't sin a pride of sin?
It certainly is. And I think that even my real-life father would admit that he perhaps erred on the side of hiding things and keeping things within our family in order to maintain that vision of our family as being above and beyond even what other church members were. He was the dean and then the president of the college, an evangelical college. And so it was probably in his best interest as well to seem to appear to have his family under good Christian control.
Self-interest is a very big part of the story on everybody's part.
Everybody character.
There's nested emotions and nested motivations for things.
Yeah, each person has their own separate desires and goals, and those clash with the other characters, obviously.
I'd like to remind our listeners, and I'm speaking with Val Berlinski. Her last name is spelled Berlinski. The Girl Who Slept with God is the title of the book, and it's published by Viking. Now, unforeseen consequences ensue when Oren puts Grace and Jory out in the boonies.
Yes.
One is Mrs. Kleinfelter, yeah. Hilda, and the other, who this actually starts beforehand, is a guy named Grip.
Mm-hmm.
Mrs. Kleinfelter, who she says to Jory and she bind over Jeopardy.
Yes.
And
true.
Says, please call me Hilda.
Yeah.
But Grip is. Well, he's an ice cream man, sort of, right?
Sort of.
Tell us about Grip.
He's the local ice cream guy. He drives a truck around and delivers frozen dairy treats to the kids and the adolescents in this small town. Although, unbeknownst to Jory originally and Grace, he often makes deliveries of slightly more psychedelic substances.
Smokables.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And no one knows exactly what he is selling to minors, but he definitely is dealing drugs out of his ice cream truck. Mm. Yeah. And he's on the lam. He's on the run. He's had trouble in Texas with doing just this sort of thing before. And he and some other of his buddies say they are hiding out in Idaho where no one would think to look for them. It's Idaho. Mm-hmm. You can go undetected there. No matter what you've done,
that's
usually.
Largely true. I think it's still true.
It is true.
Okay, here's the major unintended consequence of Oren's actions in isolating his daughters is that he does anything but isolate them. By sending Jory to public school, by introducing them to Hilda Kleinfelter, who's a really nice person.
She is.
And Grip coming around all the time.
Yep.
And the kids at the school. What happens is that Grace and Jory are starting to create what might be a normal life.
Exactly.
Exactly, you know, far away from their parents.
Yes. They're almost having a normal adolescence for a short period of time, thanks to their father attempting to totally seclude them. But instead, you know, he couldn't foresee some of the things that would occur. He was a little short-sighted. But I think he was desperate to keep them hidden. And unfortunately, or fortunately, just depends on how you look at it, they then learn some very human and, quote, what the church would call worldly lessons about what life involves. And obviously he had not intended any of those things to have happened.
I doubt if, for example, that Jory would have gone to a homecoming dance.
Never. They didn't hold things like that at
exactly.
a private fundamentalist school. Never.
I want to get back to Grace a little bit. The truth comes out about Grace, that is, to Jory.
Yes.
And she eventually finds out more or less what's going on. But Grace digs her heels in and talks about the angel. And I'm wondering, is this a self-protective hallucination? What do you think is Grace's motivation here?
This is such a wonderful question. And difficult to answer, and no one has ever asked me this, and I love it because this is something I've thought long and hard about while I was writing a book and even afterwards. Does Grace truly, genuinely believe that she's carrying God's baby? Is she in some sort of odd form of psychological denial about what actually happened to her? Is this just a protective measure? And I don't know that in the book, I don't think it's made clear. If I had to say, I would rather not say, but I think for a while she does. She may be in shock, and it may be a combination of shock and self-protection. And she was incredibly devout to begin with, almost insanely so. So her believing that this baby is God's is not that much of a stretch for her.
It's also the best possible explanation for what happened to her.
It certainly is. And there are discussions later in the book about the fact that even when she was younger, her parents had considered having her see a psychiatrist.
A Christian psychiatrist.
Well, yeah. But even for them, that was a stretch. And they're definitely worried about her mental state. There's quite a bit of discussion about that. Although sending your children or your spouse or anyone in your evangelical family to get mental help was considered to be anathema. You just simply did not do that.
This is a deeply conservative Christian community and all the ways that are important. Nothing to do with politics or anything like that. I'm sure I know what their politics are.
Right, right.
But this, everything is tightly bordered. Everything is preordained. We will do this, and you will do this because this is the right way to do it.
Exactly.
And you can't do anything else.
No. Yes? If you deviate from that plan, then you're sinning and you're not doing the will of God.
Mm-hmm. Now, Grace thinks that what happened to her not only is beyond the understanding of her family and the world, but also that she resents their doubts about this. And why are you doubting?
Yes. And she uses the Bible to contradict their doubt and says, you know, did anyone believe Jesus at first and Mary and Joseph and Abraham and everyone when they first, you know, explained what God wanted them to do? Did anyone believe them either? And of course, her parents cannot really argue against that because then they'd be arguing against the tenets of the Bible. Mm-hmm. So she, in a very ironic and somewhat funny way, she turns their own religious beliefs against them in a way they had never anticipated. It's to me, I think it's almost an odd form of teenage rebellion. You know, she says, I can't sin, so instead I'm going to be so religious that it will be scary to you.
There's a conversation with her parents later on in the book with Oren and Esther where, I'm not going to give the whole thing away, but at one point Esther says, I think I feel a migraine coming on. And Grace says, vengeance is mine.
And her father is like, don't you say anything like that. And yes, she does. Occasionally, once in a blue moon, she will say something and you realize there's a lot of anger in there somewhere.
And there's a lot of 17-year-old kid in there.
Well, yeah. How long can you repress all of that when you're 17?
Well, when it's self-repressed, it's one thing.
Right.
And when it stops being self-repressed, then it just becomes repression.
Yes.
Yeah, okay. Does that make any sense
at all?
Yes,
it did.
Okay, good. I don't know if you want to give this one away, but when Jory first starts at Schism High, she is a bit of a loner.
Yep.
She's a bit of an oddball. Mm-hmm. But eventually she starts making friends.
Yes.
Yeah. And she has to go to PE class, which, like any normal human being, she loathes and despises. And I don't know if you want to talk about this, but you want to talk about what she comes up with to get out
sure.
of PE class.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. She uses – she doesn't come up entirely with this on her own. She's in science class, and she knows that the next – classes, PE. She's been dreading it terribly. She hates being naked. She considers herself terribly flat-chested. She doesn't want even the other girls to see her. And so she's got a grim look on her face. And another student says to her, what's wrong? Girl problems? Female problems? And this sparks this idea in her head. And she thinks, yeah, sure. And her father shows up at the school, which humiliates her, bringing her PE clothes. And as they're standing out in the hall, she says, there's something wrong. And they have this long conversation in which she very obliquely refers to the fact that she supposedly started her period and therefore cannot go to PE class. And then many other things ensue because she's lied about this and people believe her and, oh, one complication after another, thanks to her pretending that she has indeed had her very first period and cannot go to PE class.
It made me wonder, not being of the female persuasion, mm-hmm. yes. When girls of that age, do they use that?
Oh, yes.
Oh, yeah, it's a tool.
Oh, absolutely. Especially during the 70s, it was, and in Idaho where things were kind of, during the 70s, it was more like the 50s and the 60s. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there was still this old idea that you couldn't swim if you were having your period. You couldn't exert yourself. You know, you shouldn't have to run laps. You might have cramps. So, yeah, back then, females did this. Oh, my friends and I did this continually. You know, oh, Miss Smith, I'm having my period. You know, oh, well, just sit on the sidelines.
That's the third time this month. Or
yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
The quote-unquote almost normal life includes one evening of dinner and music with Mrs. K and with Grip. And this is completely personal, but one of the singers you mentioned is Annette Hanshaw. I love Annette Hanshaw.
I do, too.
And I can't believe that you just pulled that out of nowhere. I have Annette Hanshaw CDs at home. Yes, this is one of the great singers of the 20s.
I love her voice. I love her songs. I just was dying to somehow worm her music into the book.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is why they have a Victrola in this old house, and it's furnished with really old furnishings. And it gives them a chance to, of course, have Grip and Mrs. Kleinfelter do some old-style dancing that Jory does not get to participate in because of her sister's aversion to sinful dancing, bodily contact between males and females. Dancing. No good.
Yes.
No.
Jory begins to get friends at school. One is a girl named Rhea.
Yep.
I like her because she's a troublemaker.
She is.
Yes. And I mean that in the best possible way. Yeah.
Yeah.
And she's not even subtle about it, but she goads Jory into doing things just by saying, well, everybody else is doing it.
Go on.
I'm doing it. Yeah. Come on. Let's do it, right? And she also meets a guy named Laird Albright.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And who becomes her friend.
Yes.
And I think takes her to the dance,
yes,
if I remember correctly.
He does.
Yes. And the thing that interested me about this goat roper school, which is supposed to be so rough and ready, is that they have their A-list and elite also.
Yes, they do.
The Mullinixes.
Sure.
Yeah. Do you want to tell us a little bit about the social structure that she finds herself
in? Yes, there's definitely a social structure, and the really cool kids are not the goat ropers. The cool kids understand what popular clothing looks like and rock and roll music. They don't listen to country. The principal's daughter and his son happen to be, two of the very most cool kids. They're very physically attractive. They come from L.A. They're really with it. Underneath that strata would be people like Rhea, who helps drag Jory up to her own, or down to her own level, as the case may be. Laird is closer to being a goat roper. His dad flies a crop duster and he lives on a farm. Lower down than that would be people who live on large farms in which the kids actually have to milk the cows before they show up for school in the morning. And this was the way it was at my school. And I unfortunately know the social strata intimately.
Ain't no 4-H club. This is real life.
Right. And yeah, that's the way it worked.
Well, there's a lot left to this story, and we're about out of time. There is an enormous crisis that happens at the end of the book, and the crisis is precipitated by the fact that Grace finally decides that she's had enough.
Yeah,
and is forced to act, and maybe doesn't act in the best way possible. And there's a confrontation between Grip and Oren.
Yep.
And he feels that Grip is trying to lure his daughters away
Definitely.
From him, which may in fact be true.
Yes.
Yeah. Although Grip is really, he's kind of a laid back character. He's not evil so much as misunderstands the milieu that he's living in.
Exactly. And he thinks he can, that there will be no problems if he does whatever it is he's doing. And he genuinely seems to care about both Grace and Jory in a way that is surprising. And they both care for him quite a bit, too. But, you know, the father gets involved and things just blow up. Mm-hmm. And then Grip's past plays a role too, because, you know, he's supposedly hiding out there. And if he's suddenly revealed to the people in charge, the Arco's authorities, things are going to get serious. So, yeah.
This family lurches from one disturbing situation to
they
another.
They do, don't they?
Yeah. So, yeah. When you conceived the idea for this book,
right.
Did you have an idea of where it was going to wind up? Did you know?
No, I did not. And in fact, my very first full draft of the novel, I'd say the last half of the book was completely different. Had a very happy, upbeat ending, if you can imagine.
I can imagine.
People get together romantically and it's all...
Kumbaya.
Yeah, things work out. Yes, yes. Even the really religious folks come to an understanding, and it was very different. And then my parents both died, and that changed me a lot in many ways. But part of me also realized that I no longer needed to protect them from the book, which was something I had been quite worried about. Since it is very autobiographical, I knew they would be disturbed by their fictional portrayals in the book. And once they were gone, I realized that the book could no longer hurt them, and I could write it in the way that felt actually much more realistic and true to the people in the book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Life is like that. It's messy.
Yeah, very.
Yeah.
Very what, messy.
If you're lucky, it's messy.
Yeah, I get, well, yeah.
It's been really,
if you're alive, it's messy.
Yeah, it's really been fun speaking with you. I've been speaking with Val Berlinski. The title of her book is The Girl Who Slept with God, published by Viking. If you come through town again with the new book, I'd love to talk to you.
Oh, I'll be here.
Okay, great. Thank you.
You'd be first on my list.
Thanks. You've been listening to Author, Author, produced at the studios of All Classical KQAC-FM in Portland. My name is Ed Goldberg. You can find these programs at our website, allclassical.org/author. Thank you for listening, and I'll be back soon.